This is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello folks, Ben here. Hope you are doing okay. This is A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers, as I think you probably already know. This is my podcast, and thank you very much for joining me. This is episode 129, I think, although I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure of anything right now, to be absolutely honest with you. So I made a big promises, didn't I, the other week about grabbing the bull by the horns and going out there and inviting all kinds of high-profile photographers onto the podcast. And it's all just kind of fallen apart since then, to be completely honest with you. Not entirely. I don't want to like over-dramatise it, but this whole coronavirus business has really taken its toll to some extent, psychologically anyway. Point is, I did try to do the best I could for you guys, and I've completely failed in that task this week. I will continue to invite interesting and hopefully high-profile photographers onto the podcast. This week, it all went entirely pear-shaped, and so you're going to have something a little different. What happened was I didn't really have any in the can, and I guess my sort of, my motivation and my will to live had somewhat diminished, I think, in light of the current situation. And then I invited the wonderful Phil Toledano on as a guest, who is someone I've wanted to have on for so, so long. And obviously, Phil is based in New York. And as you all know, I am in the habit of doing these podcasts face to face. So he was one of my on the New York list people who'd been on there for ages, along with a kind of exclusive cohort of other New York-based people for when I was finally going to get my butt over there to talk to people in person. And then, of course, the enforced remote recording process, which has been now brought in through necessity, was going to give me an opportunity to suddenly talk to people like Phil. So anyway, Phil very kindly, of course, agreed to do it. And then we were going to do it, I think, last week, and there was a bit of a hiccup because he was not at home and he had neglected to bring any kind of a computer with which to speak to me. Bit of an oversight, it must be said, but I think he only had his iPad with him. So we couldn't do it. So then we had to postpone. Then he kind of went quiet. And then I just kind of thought, well, I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think I'm going to have an episode for Wednesday, the 29th of April. And then I didn't really want to bug him because I hate doing that. So I kind of left it. And then I finally thought on Monday, I've got to give it one more go. And to my amazement, he came back and said, look, I can do it Tuesday morning. So that was his time, New York time. So I suddenly went from pretty much being resigned to not having a podcast to thinking, oh my gosh, I can do this. I can like do it and edit it. And so that's what we tried to do today. And oh my gosh, it so nearly worked out. And then just as a kind of fuck you from the muse, I suffered from rather serious internet problems, and the connection kept dropping in and out, and poor old Phil was incredibly patient, and we tried, must have been about 10 times, to have some kind of a fluid conversation, which was constantly being interrupted and truncated by the entire process being ground to a halt, basically. I had no internet connection. So oh my gosh, just when I thought I was going to snatch victory from the jaws of defeat, it happened the other way around, and I had to concede defeat, and I had to say to Phil, look, this is impossible. Let's, if you don't mind, do this another time. Because it was just, it wasn't fair to him, really. So this is a long-winded way of saying, I don't have Phil Toledano for you this week, unfortunately. And I even went out on social media to say it was going to happen because I was so kind of pleased. And I thought, oh, come on, be optimistic. Don't, you're not going to jinx it. And now I think I did jinx it because I did put the word out on social media that we were due to talk. And lo and behold, It didn't happen. And I had to crawl back to social media and let people know that actually there wasn't going to be an episode with Phil. So anyway, here's what I'm going to do instead. I thought, what can I do? There could be no episode at all, or I could try and give you something. So I think what it's going to be is an opportunity to share with you guys on the free fortnightly Small Voice episode some of the exclusive subscriber-only content that the Small Voice members have been listening to over on the members feed, which you can sign up for £5 a month at pod.fan, which is pod.fan. So anyway, that's what I'm going to do. Now, apologies, sincere apologies to you members, because you will have already heard all this stuff. You're not going to get anything new this week, and I hope that you will understand. I hope you'll forgive me just this once. It's a bit of a one-off. There will be a proper member-only episode next Wednesday featuring some brand new coronavirus check-ins that I'm going to have in the meantime. But for the time being, you're going to have to bear with me. I want all the other people who are not members to have a sense of what's going on over on the member-only feed. And the other thing to mention is that there's a brand new option available from today, which is that you can sign up at pod.fan and take out a free 7-day trial so that you can get even more of a flavour of the kind of content you're missing out on. So go to pod.fan, click on the free 7-day trial option, and you won't pay anything for 7 days. If you want to cancel the subscription before that time, fine, go ahead, and you should be able to access the member content until then. So before I tell you who's going to be on this episode, let me let you know that it's brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club, the first and only Book of the Month club dedicated exclusively to photo books. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected names in contemporary photography to select a first edition monograph that is a must-have for every collection. Each book arrives signed by the artist, along with a note card and a print from the guest curator, with free shipping to the US, Canada and the UK. Past curators have included Alex Soth, Mark Steinmetz, Andrea Modica, Todd Hydo, Ron Jude and many others. All that, along with members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more, makes the Charcoal Book Club the best and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. So here's what I'm going to bring you this week. There are 20 additional questions that everyone now gets answered, and the answers for those questions goes out on the members-only feed. I'm going to bring you the 20 questions from Miha Awanowski, who went out on episode 124, and from a couple of weeks ago, Ken Grant. And sandwiched betwixt those two sets of 20 additional questions, I'm going to bring you a recent corona check-in that I had with my guest from episode 66, the one and only Sian Davey. Please enjoy this, and I hope this gives you a sense of the kind of thing you're missing out on. Well, I'm glad you think that they're good questions. I have considered these quite carefully, and they are ones that, I mean, a lot of the listeners will kind of be familiar with some of these questions, but these are the allocated bonus content questions. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we're going to dive straight in. What would you say you've learned about yourself through being a photographer?
Because all my work is very personal, I learned a substantial amount about myself from this, because I use photography to answer pressing questions that come to my mind, and questions about existence, you know, questions about my position within the society, my position in the universe. So I spent a long time working on each project, you know, quite properly getting into it and delving into it. So at the end of each project, I usually will have learned quite a lot, and I'm very grateful to photography for this. It makes you focus on something for quite a while, think about this, look at it from different perspectives, show it and share it with people, get feedback from people. So I would say probably most of the things I learned about myself are from photography, and I find that quite wonderful that actually this is my tool of work, and that provides me with so much insight. Mm. It's glorious.
What is your greatest strength as a photographer, would you say?
Well, this is very probably for somebody else to define, but I would say from feedback I'm getting from people, maybe it's the relatability of what I talk about. Because I usually talk about very personal things, but try to make them more universal, applicable to other people. So I feel probably that is something that is works for my audiences, that kind of relatability. But maybe I'm making this up. Mm. So we better ask somebody else.
Main weakness as a photographer, would you say? So you're going to be more forthcoming about your weaknesses, as all modest people are, than you are about your strengths. No, but anyway.
No, I mean, you see, I think that my weaknesses can also be my strengths, because poor planning.
Right, yeah.
And overshooting occasionally because I haven't planned really well. This is the way my brain works. I've got slight ADHD and I just jump into things and see what happens. So that can be, if you have a job and you have to do something properly, whatever that means, that can sometimes be a problem. But I do enjoy that process. It definitely causes me a lot of work afterwards. You know, you end up with too many images, too many similar images, too many bad images as well. So I think I would like to be like a good, you know, measured photographer who just takes 5 pictures, not 50.
Right, right. But, yeah. No, not everyone can do it that way.
No, that's true.
So if you were to meet your 20-year-old self now, what advice would you give to that guy? It could be photography, or it could be just, you know, life.
As a human. Well, you know, I was thinking about this recently. That's one of the questions that keeps coming back to you. And I would definitely tell myself from 20 years ago to stop contorting and trying to fill somebody else's boots and trying to please, you know. I would say just listen to yourself. You're good as you are. You're golden. You're beautiful in the twisted ways that you are, and that's fine. That's all you have to be. There's a wonderful song that I recently have been listening to by the Phoenix Foundation, and they have this chorus that says, don't let anybody tell you that you're special. Don't let anyone tell you that all your dreams will come true. Don't let anyone tell you that the world is your oyster. The world is not an oyster. It's a cold, dark planet floating through space on a ceaseless journey to its destruction. And all you can do is to be all right about it and get on with things. You're not a loser. You're a human, and I love you. And I love you. And I just heard this, and I thought that's what I would say to anybody in school. That should be like an anthem for everybody. It really is. We're not special. We're just humans, mm-hmm. You know, and beautiful in all different ways. I think that's something I would definitely tell the Michał who was contorting and trying to, you know, be something that he wasn't really.
Right. And if you were to sort of come forward 10 years from that point, so you would be 30 or something, mm-hmm. would there be something else at that point that you'd want to?
No, I think at that point I was getting on the right horse, I think, at that time. Yeah. So it's just enjoy the ride. You're on the right tracks. Right. Have fun.
What's the one most essential lesson you would pass on to someone embarking on a photography career today?
Well, that's a tricky one. But I would say what I have learned from Dwayne Michaels. And I think he says something that you got to trust that little voice in your head, that the voice is, the voice says, what if, what could that be? And if you hear that voice, you go and follow it, because that's how I've dealt with it. A question comes up to your mind, how did they do it? And they say, well, there's only one way to find out. So I would say to any photographer, just go and listen to that voice. I would say.
Is there any advice that they should ignore, that, you know, kind of things that you hear, recommendations or advice that you hear that you just don't agree with?
I would say think twice before you enroll on a photography course.
Right.
Because there's so many photographers coming out of these BAs, masters every year, and only one of them will actually start making work. So look at that if it's really needed. But also, don't carry 10 kilograms of equipment on your back, 7 different lenses and 3 camera bodies. You don't need that. Yeah. Just get one that works for you.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. Keep it simple.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously it's interesting you say that, because in your case, doing the MA was actually pretty obviously a good move. Mm-hmm. But as you say, you know, yeah, it's going to cost money, and there are other ways that you could maybe spend that money if you're trying to develop your photography career.
I think so, yes.
It's difficult to know what the right choice is for you until you've, you know, because you don't know until you actually
give
it a try.
But just do it with awareness, you know, because there's so many ways to learn photography. And I would, if I were to do my master's again, I would definitely do my master's again because of the people I met and because of the painful lessons I received. Mm. So, but the process was, you know, you have to own that process. Mm. You're not going to be spoon-fed, which is maybe something that people expect from a university. But
How has a failure or apparent failure set you up for later success? Do you have a favorite failure of yours?
I think I go back to the masters again and that kind of confrontation of my ideas of what a good photograph was to my tutor saying that this is absolutely awful.
Really?
I needed that, absolutely, yes. Needed to be... That was the lesson I needed from it. But it was a failure because I made a lot of twee work when I was starting working with my mom on the Minus the Mother project. And the thing I was coming up with was just, you know, very flamboyant. It was very much David LaChapelle. Nothing wrong with David LaChapelle. I'm not saying. But that's
this
not
was,
the kind of work.
Yeah, this was a project you did about your mom.
Yeah,
basically.
It was a project about grieving, about the process of mourning. But I was making it a very much definitely too theatrical. And I needed to be taught.
It's very funny. It's kind of funny you should say that because Ellie Davies, who was my guest last time, Ellie was she's an old friend, but she was the first person to address these questions. You're the second, and she had a very similar experience doing her MA. You know, and someone had one of her tutors had described her work as banal, which was like basically a punch in the face.
Yeah.
But it really made a huge. It changed everything for her, and everything that happened subsequently in terms of her work has come from that. Really,
I think it's very important. I think one of the tutorials we had, Martin Parr came down, and he looked at our final projects and there was a very simple process. He put the pictures on the table and tell him what the project's about, and he just said one thing to me: this project is not about what you just said. And I thought, all right, and I loved it, you know. It wasn't it was very close to the deadline and stuff, but I needed to hear this. I know some other students got really upset, you know, who does he think he is, blah blah, that kind of stuff. But
always Martin Parr.
Well, he's a member of audience who tells me that he doesn't see in my images what I see, what I think there is, you know, what I've put into the images. Right. And that's the most invaluable kind of feedback you can get. And I mean, maybe my attitude was right for it. I'll take it and I'll think about it. And I'm grateful that my tutors like Ian Walker and Ken Grant, they just said, Ian Walker used to say, I've got a tweetometer whenever I travel with my wife, and she says, oh, look at that. Oh, look at that beautiful flower. And then tweetometer goes beep, 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 beep. So he says, I have one for your work, Michal, because your work is so twee that I just have to have this special device. And the greatest measure of my success as a photographer is I meet Ian Walker now, and he emails me after seeing Go Home Polish or Clear of People, and he says, Michal, the tweetometer didn't move once. And I feel like, wonderful.
That's a beautiful thing, yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
it's
wonderful.
Such a wonderful exchange.
That's lovely. Is there anything you've been completely wrong about?
Oh, many things. I mean,
now this could mean
life ones.
This could mean, yeah, this could be in general, but it could also mean something to do with a project or an expectation, you know, that was, you know, kind of confounded in terms of photography or whatever.
I think I would never imagine I would become a landscape photographer. And that's a big revelation to me. All my work is about landscape in that no certain way, but I never thought this. I always found landscape photography extremely boring. So I was totally wrong about landscape photography and how you can actually make it work in the different contexts, not about nature itself, but about big political questions or personal quests. And I'm so glad I was wrong about that. You know?
Yeah. Have you got a favorite photo book? And if so, why that one?
Oh, there's, I think my favorite book is by Colin Gray. It's called In Sickness and in Health, and it's about his dad looking after his mom when she's in a hospital, and then she passes away. And it's a very beautiful, simple book, but the images are, I mean, I think Colin Gray is a profound photographer, the way he actually took his parents on a journey from their kind of like mature age, very playful images. In the first book to then the books were about saying goodbye to them. And I met him once in Lithuania, and he was my photography crush. I love his
really?
Work.
Huh.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's funny because I don't know it, but I'll have a look now. Well, favorite photographer, is there anyone comes to mind?
Quite a few again, I would say, but definitely my biggest man crush is Dwayne Michaels.
Uh-huh.
I love him. Okay. I love him. I want to have dinner with him. I want to live with
is
him.
Is he still around?
Yes, he is, yes.
He must be pretty old now.
He is in his 80s.
Yeah.
But he's just such a human. He's wonderful. I mean, and the way he mixes writing with photography in the simplest way, but he can discuss quantum physics in two images with text, or like, you know, sequence of five images. And there's something so simple and so profound about him. I love Dwayne Michaels. Mm.
Any photo books you've particularly enjoyed, or photographers you've discovered for the first time just in the last year or two?
There's something that is happening, actually, and I rediscovered a photographer in the making, Nick Roche, who actually was my student a few years back, and he was always very very talented, and he's a wonderful man. But now he's
I know Nick, yeah.
You know Nick, yeah? So he's going to have his book out. I think it's called The Budgie Died Instantly or something in, along those lines. And he came back with this project, and I saw it a few months, I think in Photo Paris in November, and I was spellbound. Like, the man is a poet, and the way he took his photography so quickly as well, because he only did the courses maybe like not 3 years ago, but he is so focused, and the work is absolutely wonderful. So the book is coming out, I think, in April, and I'm actually looking forward to it. So,
oh, that's great. Yeah, I didn't realize you had something coming out.
Yeah, well, this is the Irish Contingency, the people behind the Eamon Doyle's books. They're taking it on, designing it. Yeah. Apparently, I actually saw him yesterday, Nick in Cardiff, and he shared the good news. And it was nice because I had already, I was anticipating something good for him. So that's wonderful.
Great. Well, he'll enjoy getting a mention, Miha, on the podcast, because I know he listens. So,
oh, I know. Well, he deserves it. Hi, Nick.
So when you feel overwhelmed or unfocused, or you feel kind of creatively exhausted or uninspired or stuck, what do you do to get yourself moving forward again? Are there any particular kind of techniques or strategies that you have?
Well, I try to be kind to myself and not put pressure on myself. Like, life sucks as it is, so I just try to be kind. But definitely walking is something that I do. I also watch.
Do you ever?
I also watch tons of documentaries about the universe or the deep ocean. That is my default setting. The universe, the space, and the two kind of boundaries of our human existence is. And I actually project a lot of this. I'm a bad sleeper. I'm quite, a bit of an insomniac. So my technique before falling asleep is imagining I can traverse the universe and go from planets to planets or the bottom of the ocean. And that usually actually gives me the space to think about something important after a while, once I kind of meditated. But that's how I would.
How do you deal with self-doubt when it arises? Do you have any kind of strategies or habits that you come back to for that? Assuming you have.
Oh, Jesus, of course. It's crippling. I mean, I am a good Polish Catholic, I'm not really, but I definitely whip myself properly when self-doubt comes, and it comes very often. I have to write it out in form of, like, expose myself to it. So I'm cruel, absolutely cruel to myself. But then usually it kind of, like, goes, and I am getting better at being patient and not actually. Sometimes you get an email from somebody just in the right moment to say, hey, we would like to put a show of your work somewhere. Or somebody says, I loved your work. So you get a little boost, but I don't have a technique to get rid of it straight away. It takes a while. When I was walking, it was awful, awful.
Yeah, yeah. So what other art forms or cultural output do you take inspiration from, apart from the documentaries with the space and ocean? So, painting or poetry or even TV or, fiction. Any favorite artists, programs or websites that are kind of essential to you?
I don't watch television at all, so I don't have access to this kind of stream of stuff that is thrown at me. So I choose quite carefully what I watch, and it can be, as I said before, quite a lot of space programs. But written word, probably short forms, because my attention span is pretty awful. So short stories or poetry. I love music. Laurie Anderson for me is one of those people that I always return to, because she mixes. She gives me a life-affirming experience in 2 minutes. And it involves music, comforting voice, and a story that lifts me. So that would say that kind of work definitely it inspires me. Otherwise, I would say people and the world, nature. That's where I usually get my inspiration from. I mean, that sounds so corny. But little sentences here and there, and I just mull over them. Little slogan, little graffiti.
So you, Your ADHD thing is genuinely a problem. You don't read novels or stuff because you find it just hard to
It's very difficult. I mean, I did because I had to when I was doing my master's, but it is painful. It's physically painful for me to sit still, for me to read a long form. So, and I'm also very compulsive. So sometimes I can actually read a whole, you know, like when I was reading Joyce, a whole book in one day, you know, like The Portrait of the Artist, So I can do it, and I do it in compulsive spurs, but then I don't touch another book for a year or two, you know. So I have a pile of books. People buy books to me all the time, and they're very beautiful books that I really want to read, but it's, again, the hedgehog and the dog, you know. They're there, but yeah, it's tricky.
What's the thing you like most about photography or about being a photographer?
Probably the flexibility it offers, because it seems like there's endless possibilities, and it's very forgiving when you marry it with other forms. You can marry it with, I mean, if of course there's risks, but with text, for example, there's ways you can rediscover it. You can make it your own. Also, it is very generous to people like myself who have no talent for drawing or any other kind of visual kind of skill. So it gives you that kind of framework of making images. It's very playful, which I love. It's very flirtatious. It's joyful, you know? Like, I think photography is perfect to match the childlike curiosity of a grown-up man. It can turn a grown-up man into a child. It's a toy, but then it's a language that really can be profound. And I think I find that that's photography's greatest strength for me.
I love that. What's the thing you like the least? And that could be just about, you know, I don't know, not having any money or, you know, whatever. Yeah, but I mean, you've kind of solved that problem by doing what a lot of people do, which is to you know, take on a teaching role.
Yes,
yeah. What do you like the least about being a photographer or about photography?
You know, I think there's a lot of misconceptions in about photography and such. It is a medium that is so ubiquitous, yet people really don't get it as much. There's so many different strands in photography, and I get often asked, oh, you're a photographer, you should go to Brecon Beacons and photograph, and I have no interest, but people put you in, weddings, or do you do this, so this, it's so precious to me to be a photographer, and it's such a personal thing, but for others it can be just something as silly like, oh, can you take my passport photograph? So I think the audiences are quite limited. It's a secular kind of pool of people you reach through your photography, you know, unless you're making commercial work, which I'm not really interested in. So I would say the audience reach is quite problematic sometimes, no?
What do you think the best thing you've done so far for A, your career, and B, your creativity, if that's a different thing?
Well, with career, I think the best I did was sticking with it and being patient with it and managing expectations as well. I think not expecting to, like you say, make a lot of money and redefining what success really means. And the greatest thing for me was to realize that I am a very successful photographer in my mind because I do what I like and I communicate the things that are important to me. And I have no other expectations of it. I don't need to be getting awards. I need to be doing this. I feel like I'm fulfilled, you know, in the fact that I have a tool that allows me to say things that I want. And there's a few people who enjoy it, you know. And for my creativity, I think, again, the best moment was when I stopped trying hard and actually started listening to myself. Like, honestly, like, what is it that you're doing here? Who are you doing this for? Is it important? Are you trying to stroke your ego? Do you want to be a rock star? You know, and once you answered all these questions and brought it back to the very basis of, you know, communicating, that was a very good moment, accepting that, you know. I'd say,
What do you think you would have done if not photography? Would you have been good at it?
I wanted to be a vet when I was younger, but then I realized I cannot really put animals down. And also, I like to be appreciated for what I do. So, you know, with animals, they sometimes you have to cause pain, to be cruel, to be kind. So I thought that's not for me. But probably writing or being a language teacher. No, like, I used to teach English back in Poland, so I could do that. It's very boring at some point, I guess. But writing is something that I do enjoy and want to explore more. So probably that would be something to do.
Yeah, you would be good at that, for sure. You would, I think.
I think I could be. I think there's potential in that. I just need to apply myself to it. But I've known, like, throughout my life, I was an excellent housekeeper at the Hilton when I came to Britain. Of course, as a good immigrant, the first job was to work in a hotel. So I was excellent housekeeper. And then I was a great waiter when I was working in a restaurant. I was a great manager of a cafe. So I feel like really those jobs, there's quite a few I could put my mind to and I could master.
If it all goes wrong, you could...
I have a sense of pride in anything that if I apply myself to it, I don't have a problem in doing any job. Like I enjoy working. And I think that actually housekeeping was one of the nicest jobs. It was toughest, but it was such a simple formula for satisfaction. You got a list of 12 or 15 rooms. You've got 8 hours. You go in and you do it. And, you know, you find mess, you leave order. Oh, it was like, I was like a god, you know. It was wonderful.
Yeah. That's kind of slightly OCD kind
maybe
of
maybe a little bit. Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm with it. I could get into that as well.
I know some people. You know, maybe we can do a few shifts at the Hilton together.
It might come to it. Anyhow.
Times are tough, right?
Okay. Final question: are you happy?
Absolutely. Yes. I'm very happy. I'm very happy with what I have. I don't need anything else in my life. Then the happiness comes from the fact that I accept the world with its beauty and its ugliness. I accept myself with my ugliness and my beauty. I've stopped stressing and trying too hard. And once I did this, again, I feel like I'm untouchable. Things happen around that are negative, and I embrace them. You know, it's part of the experience. I do not expect an American Disney movie because I wish I had been told that as a child. I wish we were teaching our children that death is part of life. Pain is part of life, as important, as valuable as the joyful moments, you know? And I had to work that out for myself through a few tough times. And I'm super grateful because now I feel like I can ride this until my grave with joy, you know, with a smile.
Fantastic way to end it. I love the way you answered positively without the slightest hesitation. So... yeah, that's a great sign. Thank you, Michal. It's been absolutely brilliant. I've really enjoyed chatting
with you.
Thank you
so much.
I appreciate you doing it.
It's been a joy. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah?
Sorry, but my mom is crazy.
I know that already. Honestly. I really do.
He knows that.
Yeah, I do.
Right.
Yeah. Hi, Ben.
How are you doing?
How am I doing? Well, actually, it's quite interesting. I mean, I kind of wrote on my Instagram post, it was like whiplash. And, you know, and I think, like everyone, I've just been running off my adrenals for too long and, you know, still don't know how to put that kind of almost flight or fight thing down to survive this nuts world. So, you know, like everyone, I'm thinking, all right, got to produce this and, you know, got to make this and got to do my yoga and how am I going to manage the kids? And it all became just a bit too busy. And then I just dropped it. And, you know, I just carried on making work because that's what I do. Anyway,
how did you manage to do that though? That's the question. Just like that kind of thing.
Because it was just, I had this incredible, you know, this anxiety actually, and I stopped sleeping.
Right. Yeah. I think a lot of people are going to be having trouble sleeping.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm also, I do have Martha's coming back soon, and I have a 15-year-old to manage, and Alice with special needs. In this house, it could be for weeks. She's had pneumonia twice. So I just took her out of school early, and now she's close to me, I feel, you know, a lot more stable, actually.
Yeah, I think that in description of this feeling like whiplash is a good one.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be doing this with a lot of people, but when I saw your Instagram post, that's when I realised I should talk to you, really. Because you were in the middle of a project or maybe even getting towards the end of it. I don't know.
Well, I had this, you know, I was part funded by the Eugene Smith and the Wellcome Trust to make this body work about poverty and mental health. And interestingly, the year before, I knew that I just couldn't be in airports anymore. it just didn't feel okay just to keep doing that. You know, two things, the environment, secondly, being away from my kids and the stress of that. So I kind of put it up then. I said, I just need to make work close to home. And also I was profoundly impacted by, you know, the polarization in our society and almost this kind of disconnection and negation of responsibility towards vulnerable and the vulnerable, and actually how vulnerability becomes pathologized. So I decided in response to that to kind of put out for funding, which I was, you know, really gratefully received. But I think what was really important for me is I chose to work 10 minutes from my house.
Yeah.
In Torbane.
So did you make that decision first and then find a story that would allow you to do that? Or was that sort of story floating around, as it were?
Oh, no. It wasn't kind of really floating around. It came at me like, you know, it just really came at me very strongly. And, you know, sometimes creative work comes at you from, you know, it just jumps on you, you know, and when you least expect it. And a couple of things happened at that time that I was in Brighton, my hometown. It's not where I live now, but where I grew up. And there was there were tents from Queen's Road by the station all the way down to the seafront. People sleeping in tents and self-medicating with drugs and alcohol because obviously mental health services don't exist. Mm. And they're getting pathologized for being crazy, and they're not. They're just trying to manage you know, desperate situation. And then a couple of other things happened. And anyway, my friend, a senior health visitor, said, Sian, you've got to make work. She ran me on the way home from seeing another desperate situation. And I was brought up in temporary accommodation until I was 14, in and out of. So I just thought, actually, I'm just going to transfer what I do at home with my kids into the world and make work with it. So that's what I did, I think, yeah.
Would you do me a favour? Will you just read out that post that you made on Instagram? Will you just read it for me?
I'm trying to come to terms with the abrupt ending of the making of the series. It gave me meaning and purpose. Of course, I will continue once this crisis is over, knowing that the work will be more relevant than ever. Alice is vulnerable. She has had pneumonia twice, so we are now on day 6 of self-isolating for the long haul. I feel deeply reassured that she is close to me. And there are edges. I'm reliant on my community to bring me supplies, supermarkets stripped out, and listen to me from these four walls. I'm doing all the right things, trying to get excited about online yoga, homemade gyms, online art classes for kids, building tents, and acceptance. Alice, who described how we were feeling as whiplash, and it felt right. I feel shocked and I'm grieving some of the life that I loved. Before long, I will reflect on the hope of a new consciousness. This pandemic has revealed gaping holes in our care infrastructure. And for the future, we can only hope that it will force us to reconsider who we are and what we value, and help us to rediscover the better version of ourselves. As I write this, Alice leaned across and planted a huge kiss on my lips and said, "Oh, Mummy, I love you. Right now, it's the moment."
Thank you. So what's your go-to strategy for kind of managing the stress of it all then? What should we do about that?
Well, you know, I'm feeling like, I mean, I there is, just to be honest, actually, it's really hard.
Mm.
And I think I was in denial like most people, you know, trying to be, you know, you hear people saying, well, I'm going to make that book I've never made, or I'm just going to become, you know, I'm just going to get fit, you know, I'm going to do all these kind of things that I should have done. And then it just becomes another fucking tool to hit ourselves with, another kind of stick to hit ourselves with. And I just think, actually, can we just slow down and be in relationship with ourselves and start with just making sense of that?
Mm.
Slowing down. You know, there was that whole slowing down, the whole slow movement, which it kind of didn't work. I think we will see a whole new consciousness from that. I really hope we do. We've got two very fucking useless, Trump and Boris, and they're just not built for the job, you know. And I think this will hopefully bring about more serious politicians, actually.
Well, you'd like to think so, but I you know, they are beyond what anyone would even imagine. Anyone would be better, especially Trump. But the idea that we could have a whole new sort of level of leader seems like a distant dream in a way.
Well, it may do, but we haven't started yet. We haven't started. And I think people, I'm just really in, I mean, I'm in the process of, I will be working from home because I just can't put it down. But because I'm now in contact with a lot of homeless people and they've been contacting me since. So when I can find some space, you know, there's that thing going on on Facebook or somewhere about kids, mothers working at the desk, you know, the kitchen table, and the kids are bound up. Mm. And I'm close to it. But I think it's inevitable. It's just inevitable. People will start remembering what it's like to be in relationship. I need people, actually, you know. And I'm here right now. Something's happening. People are ringing me up saying, I really want to support you. Something's happening. My son, who's 15, doesn't have to hang out with his mates and feel self-conscious anymore and feel like he has to compete and all those kind of difficult kind of existential stuff of being a 15-year-old. He's now going to the woods with me every day with Alice. And we walk into the woods and we just kind of pack up some food. And he just jumps around in the wall and we just smash up a few sticks and it's simple. I never imagined that would ever happen. And he says, are we going out now? So these really kind of very simple things have become simple. And we, Ben, I just can't believe there won't be some change. And I think there will be.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, I hope so. I think it depends how cynical one is about human nature, I suppose. I mean, I think this sort of thing, as you've said already, sort of does definitely brings out the best in humanity. But then also we do have very short memories. So one wonders if however long this lasts and then 6 months or 12 months after that, whether we'll have basically forgotten everything that we're learning now. I don't know. I'm not saying that will happen.
But I think the country's bank balance won't forget.
That's true.
And I think that's going to take a long time and very clear leadership, and we don't have it because he is a buffoon and he's not serious. And I think we've had a lot of complacency in politics for a long time because there's been wealth in this country and it's just caused this kind of sedation. And I think sometimes it takes this kind of extraordinary, it does take crisis to wake up and for people to know what they need.
Yeah.
And I think that's being identified right now. We know what we need. We need, you know, the self-employed need an income. You know, we need support. You know, so we begin to, you know, on that level, on many levels. But, you know, the homeless, where are the homeless going? And anyway, there's less in this, isn't there?
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking that this issue of how the hell people are going to get through it financially for us self-employed people is much more of a worry than, you know, any concern about getting sick.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course it is, because it makes you sick. Your mental health makes you sick.
Yeah. And also, you know, there's a kind of simple kind of statistical element to it, which is that you've got the chances of, you know, getting sick or someone you know getting sick, and then the chances of that being serious or being fatal. But then the chances of this having a really serious financial impact, that's 100% right there. You know what I mean? This will definitely fuck a lot of us up really badly financially.
Absolutely. But there is something, we're all in the same, we're all in it together. There is something about that. Most of us are.
Yeah, that's exactly what Vanessa said yesterday. Exactly yeah. what she said. You know. So but it's all too kind
of solidarity in that. It just feels very different. Anyway, yes, carry on.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just going to say it's all too relevant to this piece of this body of work you've been working on. It's almost uncanny, really, because you know it is about those things that you just talked about. You know, this kind of financial, neglect of a certain sector of society. Are you going to keep doing it?
Extraordinary. Of course, I'm going to do it. I'm absolutely passionate about it. And I mean, it's interesting how my life has evolved, because actually my second degree was in social policy. It's in politics, of course. And so I spent my 20s, I was on all the demonstrations, and I was deeply political, and I was a feminist, and I belonged to the anti-pornography movement. And then in my 30s, I just had to go inside, actually, through the whole psychotherapy process and find my ground. Mm-hmm. And I have my ground, and I have a voice, and I have a responsibility as a photographer, as an artist, to talk about what's happening out there and give the voice a voiceless. And I feel very passionate about that. And the more I'm out there and the more I'm touched by humanity so profoundly, the more I want to express that we are just no different. I mean, it's kind of seamless in all my work, actually. It was in Alice, and particularly that, to close that gap. It's not about, yes, it is about politics, but it is about humanity.
Yeah.
So, yes, the work will definitely is continuing, because, of course, as I said, I'm in contact with people right now, and I have ambitions for the project. My Katie Barron, the director of the Michael Hoppin Gallery, is going to be curating the show, and I'm hoping that it will continue in some form. Well, there'll be an outcome for it, but the process is still very much in motion.
Yeah. I like that portrait that you put up of that gentleman. Who is that guy? Can you tell me about him?
Well, actually, I had this idea for him, which I didn't, I didn't let him know till I went out into the woods. It was winter. And he's one of my neighbours, and he'd been washing up in the local cafe. He's 58, he's only 58, and he's got rheumatoid arthritis, and he kind of crept up on him. And so he couldn't work, and he had to apply for universal credit. And I was just really struck, he was getting thinner and thinner. What happened was that he didn't have a computer. He has a lot of anxiety around technology. So trying to jump on the universal credit system was impossible.
Mm.
Just impossible. So I asked him to get involved in the project. And what I didn't know was that he just had no food. He just had no food. He was starving. He was sleeping all day. He was sleeping half the week to eke out his rations at home. So we were feeding him here. And then I, because I'm at the food banks every week, I'm not photographing at the food banks, actually. I'm just there every Friday listening. I just really need to understand, before I get this camera out, what's happening. So I'm just listening to stories. And so I just looped him in with the food bank, and then I take him there every 2 weeks.
Right.
And he's just trying to, and now because he's in debt with his rent, because he couldn't jump on the system, he just can't catch up. And it's the whole issue around what happens when someone, for him, very clearly, it's like, I have no value, I have no economic value, so therefore I don't exist.
Hmm. This is what when they talk about slipping through the cracks, that's exactly what they're talking about, right?
Yeah, and people like him just go to bed and they die in their sleep. he reframed that, because I'm recording people, I have a sound recordist I'm working with. He reframed that experience as, they were my fasting days.
Right.
Like, they were my fasting days. That is how he managed to kind of elevate the situation from actually the reality of the horror of it.
I like what you said about running on your adrenals. I guess that's the default mode for most of us.
Yeah, because we have to. Because, yeah. You know, and we know, unless we start regulating these rents and we start taking care of, you know, all the way down in social policy, and we have a better kind of more, anyway, then we just will have to keep running because we can't keep up with it.
Yeah.
And
so maybe, you know, this will encourage us all to just slow down a little bit and, you know, take a breath.
I hope so. And, you know, my concern right now is that there are real concerns out there right now. And the food banks, interestingly enough, as the NHS is and mental health services aren't meeting the needs of people, what we have is community organisations who are just picking up that slack. So all over the country, we have these community groups who are just really holding, you know, picking up the mental health services can't. We've got food banks, which is a whole new phenomenon, which has somehow become normal. They're all run. Most of them are run by the voluntary sector of people who are over 70. So the food banks are closing down. The food bank that I was working in every week is closing, is shut.
So that's when it's needed the most.
That's when we need the most. So that, you know, there are, anyway, I haven't even begun to look at it because I've just been trying to find my ground with my children here and make sense the next few months.
Yeah, of course. Oh my gosh, you've got a lot on your hands. Do you, is it in some way a relief to be out there in isolation to some extent, though, rather than it, because, you know, it's not a, if you're going to be in isolation, you might as well be out in nature like you are.
Well, my life is a lot simpler.
Yeah.
You know, in many ways, I stopped photographing the children. And, you know, Alice is quite resistant to me photographing her anyway these days. And Joseph is a bit, but they've just been a bit more tolerant. And Joseph's even agreed to let me shave his hair off again.
wait a second. So, I mean, yeah, so it's a good job you got Alice done before she got to the point where she was going to start objecting.
Yeah.
And and how's the one with Joe going, your son, is who you are, who you have been?
That's obviously been on a, you know, that's been on pause because he's a teenager.
Yeah.
He's really self-conscious, and the work that I do with him is, you know, we're shaving off his hair. And he was
so
always
about?
Well, it's about all sorts of things, and I didn't realize what it was about till we did it. And actually, it was very collaborative, like all my work is. And he wanted to do it, and then when he did it, I realized that we were really deeply reconnecting to a place that was kind of almost pre-verbal between us, and it was so moving, the work making it. But I had this camera up, and I was photographing with this 10-8, which is a very different way of working for me, but somehow it amplified all our histories in that moment. So it was almost like an amplification of our DNA. It was really extraordinary. And I had this, he sat there and we shaved it off his head. It's very ritualistic and, you know, almost like monastic. It felt deeply monastic actually. And I remember just kind of leaning across and just stopping the process just to go and kiss him. And I was so moved by him. And so I have no doubt, like all our work, and I don't think anyone's exempt for that, we're driven by something that we need to make sense of, something to resolve. But it's been, I had to let go of that and just be present with him and what he's needs are, But now he's not going to be in. No one's going to see him with shaved hair, the shaved head. I just jumped on that moment, obviously, and went, Joseph, what do you think?
Right.
Should we get that hair off? And he said yes. So I'm coming back. I'm just being present. I'm coming back to working at home. I'm not going out to photograph people because I'm not going to put my daughter at risk. So the project is on hold. I am still in communication with all the people I'm working with, the community groups, the individuals. I'm going to be recording them with my sound recorders about how they are and what's happening for them. So my home is my workplace.
Well, just as well right now, because we're all pretty much confined to barracks.
We are. We most definitely are. I mean, it's extraordinary, like day 7, and I just think, oh, my God, it's so intense, isn't it? It's just so unbelievably intense.
Yeah. I don't even know whether I'm allowed to go and see my boy, you know. I mean, trying to figure that out at the moment. He's at his mum's, but, you know.
Well, I've got it. You know, it's so complicated, isn't it? The different narratives, the stories are extraordinary that are coming out of this about, you know, my ex-partner has a new partner with kids. And I don't feel safe that she's there because they are still going to the supermarket and they're still in the bus. And Annis is very vulnerable. So we have all these tensions. Like, he wants to see her and I want him to see her.
Yeah.
But we have to somehow navigate that to keep our children safe.
Absolutely.
You know, keep our family safe.
Everybody, because the whole point is it's everyone. A kind of collective effort.
Absolutely.
You know?
We just got to slow this down very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Take responsibility. So only 3 days ago, I'm in lockdown, and my local cafe was absolutely heaving with people.
Oh, really? Oh, my God.
Over 100 people in that cafe heaving.
And it's a kind of insanity.
It's fucked up. It's fucked up. And I just felt like just running in there going, do you think I want to be in my fucking house any longer than I have?
Yeah.
My kids. Alice wakes up at 6 and I don't stop until she's asleep at 8. And then I just fall asleep. You know, there is no space. Mm. And and people are stripped out all the shelves. So I'm now reliant on people picking up what they can because I can't order online. I think things will calm down.
Yeah, hopefully. We're gonna have to settle into this reality.
We're gonna have to cooperate and just cooperate a bit more and be a little bit more collaborative, I think.
Well, thank you so much for checking in with me.
You're welcome, Ben.
It's always lovely to hear you talking. And,
I mean, I really hope that everyone doesn't out there. You know, I was talking to I have a photography group, 5 of us. Actually, we've got a Zoom session this afternoon, so we'll keep that going. But I just really hope that people quieten their ambitions in this process.
Yeah.
Don't feel like they've got to be the one that makes the project about the virus.
Yeah, Jesus, God help us.
the work will be made and it needs to be made. But actually, you know, drop the anxiety.
Yeah.
You know, I've got this, for me, I've been making this like work out there. It feels so important and it feels even more important right now. But I can't do it. And I'm not meant to be doing it. I need to, really listen in somewhere else. So anyway, that's what I'd say to all the people out there. Don't panic. Find your creative in the form that it needs to be. So thank you, Ben. I hope you get to see your son.
Yeah, I think I think I will. I'm just trying to figure out what the rules are, because it seems a little unclear. But people can find you. So just if people want to see that Instagram post we were talking about with that picture, one of the portraits from your project, which is called Testament, the project, and it's Sian David 1. So Sian, S-I-A-N-D-A-V-E-Y 1 is your Instagram handle.
Yeah.
Sian, lovely speaking to you, and so lovely to see Alice. That's the first time I've ever seen her in person, so that was a thrill.
Thank you. I'm about to go and play Tense, followed by a game of football, walk in the woods. And
that sounds all right to me. Sitting here in Dalston, man, I tell you what, that sounds pretty good.
You know, I'm quite fortunate now to be here and not in Brighton. It's good. And then I have a Zoom session with my wonderful photography group. So,
all right, well, say hello to all of them.
I will do. And
Thank you.
Okay, Ben. Loads of love.
Yeah, you too. Take care of yourself. Bye.
Bye, Ben.
First one is, what have you learned about yourself through being a photographer?
Probably learned that I need to be patient. I've probably learned that I need to spend quite a lot of time looking at the work I'm making to be sure it's right. I've learned that it gives me a way to speak to people who I care about, who I wouldn't necessarily have the opportunity to spend time with. Yeah, I think that's pretty much that.
If you had to name your sort of greatest strength and perhaps your main weakness, what would those two things be as a photographer, not as a human being?
Well, I could be smart and say doubt for both answers, you know, because I think you having that kind of humility to be unsure about what you're doing is not a feature that seems to be prevalent in quite a lot of photography, but it certainly helps me, because I want to check that I'm doing things in the way that I need to. I want the pictures to be lasting, you know, so they might be slow coming, but I want them to be lasting, and that's really quite important that I spend quite a lot of time with them. In terms of a weakness, then, you know, you can be kind of unsure and procrastinate a little bit too much, and that's where some of that comes in. But there's that Sudek thing again, you know. I do spend a lot of time until I'm sure with things. And I remember working with Marketa Luskacheva years ago, and she would do this strange thing where she'd have a box of prints, and when I'd go down, I'd do the same. And I worked with her as an assistant for a while, and we'd do the commercial jobs, but then she'd have a pile of pictures, and I'll have a pile of pictures, and then you go through them, and you'd put together the ones that you liked, and then she'd initial them on the back. And then you go 3 months later, you'd be doing another job, whatever it was, and you go through another set of pictures, and then she'd go through them and she'd say, you liked this one this time, but you didn't like it last time. What's changed? So you'd always, you know, I'd be conscious that there's room for error. And so spending a little bit more time getting that right, and also, you know, holding off until, I don't have that many people I show pictures to, but when I do show them, I kind of I really value their opinion. I think it's part of the process, and that doesn't happen every day. That could happen, you know, over a long time.
If you could meet your 20-year-old self now, what advice would you give that guy?
Oh God, what would I say? Probably. Don't do that much different to what you've already done. Yeah. You know, I think it's don't be sidetracked. Maybe be a little bit more collegiate in the sense that I think one of the things I really missed in when I first came back to Liverpool in the 90s was a network of people you know, my network was Marketa or Killip or different people in different parts of Europe who would go and stay, you know, stay with from time to time, and that went that there's no replacement for that. It was wonderful, but I think sometimes the isolation would knock you sideways, even when you didn't really know it was happening, you know. So the idea of having a bit of time with other people now is kind of interesting through not so much even through the kind of digital networks that have opened up, but I think that the fact that many, many more people seem to be able to have conversations and set certain things up. You know, there's initiatives in Liverpool even now where people get together in bars and talk about photography. And, you know, I think in terms of like creative development or mental health or any of that kind of stuff, not that I've struggled with either, those kinds of things, that I can see those things are important for other people. And so I'm much more ready now just to put the brake on, just go and have a coffee with people or go and have a quick bite to eat or a beer or something with people when we can get out and about, of course, and just enjoy the time with people. There's quite a few people who have, you know, I just keep an eye on, because I think they're great photographers, but they're very easily prone to have a wobble if they're not looked after. So I'd say, yeah, be a bit more collegiate.
So what's the one kind of most important piece of advice you'd give someone who's, you know, trying to embark upon a photography career today? I guess the sort of people that you know, have as your students.
Well, I think it's probably about being realistic about how long it takes to make a piece of work. I think it's easy to find really, really quick examples. I work with master students, and there's some incredible people who've come through, you know, and they're not just advertising it. They teach you something. There's a lovely thing that Funkaberta said once, Juan Funkaberta, where he talks about this kind of reciprocation. You know, you're learning through teaching and teaching through, it comes both ways. And I think that happens with a lot of the people we come across, because quite often they're mature photographers or they're people who've got commercial aspects to their lives, which seem to be ticking over, but they all come back for a certain something. And that might be a kind of critical community, or that might be an honest appraisal of what they're doing, or that might just be to park one part of their life and start another one. And I think some of those things take a bit of time. Mm-hmm. And the idea of having a few years to work through something is never a bad thing. But to understand that and to be, I suppose, to be patient about those, and to have some of those dead ends not necessarily throw you off the horse, so to speak, is really, really important. So getting some of that across, having some of that kind of understanding about how long it takes to do things. Most of the people who finish with us would have really great projects, but then they need to go on further probably and consolidate those, and then start to think about how they might become the final pieces or the books or the exhibitions. And it happens quickly enough, but to understand that those kinds of building that kind of momentum takes a bit of time, building those friendships, finding, like you said, those designers and publishers who are going to be the right people for them, and, you know, and not necessarily losing sight of that, and not being too anxious if that doesn't happen in a month or so.
Is there any advice they should ignore? Is there any are there any recommendations you hear a lot that you totally disagree with?
Not really. I think there's quite often there's conversations around editing, around sequencing work, and, you know, you only have to look online, you'll find any number of thousands of experts telling you how a photo book should be sequenced or could be sequenced. But I think with all those kinds of clues, hints and bits of advice, it has to feel authentic, and there has to be a sense of recognizing what's authentic about that piece of work. It would be, you know, quite common to have a conversation, for example, with myself and then with other photographers, and somebody's got to take all those but also find their own way within all of that. And that's a much more mature way of doing it. We can only respond to something, but there might be things that we don't quite realize. But I suppose it's interesting, you know, showing. I used to do the rounds in London, which I hated, in terms of some of the magazines I first started working with, when I had an affiliation with Network for a short time, a picture agency. And some people, you'd learn a lot by looking at them rather as they were looking at your work, rather than looking at what they were looking at. You could, because you knew your folio, or you knew your sequences. So working out what stopped them, working out what they glossed over or got tired with, you know, it's not often people would do that, but it helps.
How has a failure or an apparent failure set you up for later success? Do you have a favorite failure of yours?
I would say so much. Maybe when I was, here's the conversation we were just having about taking your time. You know, I made, when I was at Farnham, it was really quite a formative time in many respects. You know, some of the most interesting people there were not necessarily photographers, but they provide some kind of context for you. People like Peter Hall, who's a sculptor, who I know that in some of the maybe David Moore mentioned him. I think I heard your podcast with David. But these are people who would have this very inclusive understanding about culture and about cultural values and about what it was you were trying to do. And I would have the kind of useful, I suppose, wish to get things out quickly and get things done. And it was probably around then I started to think about slowing things down a little bit. And I remember making a piece of work about a housing estate I lived in, because, you know, the thing I didn't tell you was that when I was down there, I'd be processing film, but I'd also be photographing on the days I couldn't process film, or days I was out and about. And I made quite a lot of work, and I made a really, I think, quite tight sequence of pictures that maybe someday Craig Atkinson would be interested in, because he's asked to do some more. But it kind of worked, and it worked really well, and it was full of pictures, it was full of language, it was full of phrases that people had left with me, and I thought, this is great. And I showed it to everyone, and they all seemed to bite on it as well, and thought it was, you know, so people like Peter Hall, all these. And then I thought, I've got the formula now, this is great, this is how it's going to be. So I went back to Liverpool, bang, 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 put this thing together, and went back down thinking, here it is, you know, image and text with all these other little kind of inflections. And everybody just found their own particular way to let me down gently, that this wasn't quite working. And, you know, it went from people saying this is crap to other people saying, well, you know, there's that lovely Seamus Heaney thing where he finds one phrase in a bad piece of poetry and says, this is where you start. And I think somebody did that to me as well, you know. So that was it. But yeah, that made me realize, you know, there's not one size fits all for these different things. And every time you're making something, it's got its own particular outcome. That's not the easiest thing to follow, because you get sure with a certain thing or a certain technique or a certain approach photographically, and then you maybe roll it out for something else and it doesn't necessarily fit. So it takes a little bit to maybe unravel that a bit.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you have a favourite photo book? If you had to pick one.
Oh, well, there's plenty of things I really love, you know, from the very early things like Time in New England by Strand to Killip's In Flagrante, of course, I'd love. Chauncey Hare's Interior America, I'd probably go for every time. And then I suppose if there's one that I think would reach people really quickly, it'd be Drum by Crass Clement. And Crass, I ended up bringing them over to Belfast. If it's lovely, one of the lovely thing about teaching, which, you know, is always a complete privilege. I never realized when I was early on that it'd be something that I'd be able to do, is that if somebody really, really moves you, why don't you get them in a room and try and work with them or listen to them and talk to them. And Crass is probably one of those people. And he was somebody who was kind of apprehensive for most people when you speak to them. Well, he might not do this, he might do that. Luckily, because he knew me pictures and he came across and he did this really beautiful presentation about drum, and it was probably one of the most humble but also the most incisive, because he would tell you everything. And drum, for people who don't know it, is a book made through something like 3.5 rolls of film or whatever it is, on one night in a bar in the centre of Ireland, where he goes into the bar and he's there for a residency or something in that particular area, and things are not necessarily doing too good in his own mindset, and he goes into the bar and things are not necessarily ticking over too well, and he notices a guy come into the pub. And then throughout the course of the night, that particular man listens to everyone's conversation but doesn't ever be included in the conversation. And it's quite a phenomenal set of pictures. Crass studied filmmaking, and it'd be very, very easy and I suppose obvious to say the way that the books, it's almost as if you were watching this sequence roll out like a film, but it's a little bit more complicated than that if you stay with it. But he photographed that one night and photographed that guy. And when he was with me in Belfast, he said he never saw the guy ever again. He went to the bar loads of times to try and photograph him again and never saw the guy again. But I was in Dublin just when it was published, and an old friend of mine, Christine Redmond, who's done a hell of a lot for photography in Ireland, was around the kitchen table one morning after a few of us had all been to stay with her and have a kind of catch up. And it was one of the few times when it must have been what was happening for the Impressionists when the painting was unveiled and people just started to fight each other because they were outraged. You know, the book divided people around the table in such a way. And I guess that, for me, I'm glad I came down on the right side of the fence on that, because I think it's beautiful. And then when you finally meet Crass Clement, and I did this with the students, I showed the series and I showed a picture I'd taken of him, and you realise that the guy is just the spitting image of Crass Clement. So it's wow. he's photographing somebody he recognises in himself.
Yeah, interesting. I'll have to have a look at that. And do you have a favourite photographer? If you had to pick one,
there's a few. You know, probably I'd say I'm very fond of the people I've worked really closely with. You know, Tom's been around. Tom Wood's been around since I was a young lad, really, and always enjoyed his company, and always enjoyed his enthusiasm, always enjoyed his obsession with everything from literature to music, to getting the sound right, to getting the valve amp right, to listen to Johnny Cash instead of, you know, something else, to listen to something else, and, you know, which can be baffling as well as incredibly beautiful. You know, and we share lots of things which kind of lift us in some ways. I could probably say Marketa as well, because Marketa Luskachev has saved my bacon on more than one occasion in terms of working with her. But also, you know, it's a woman who's absolutely driven in her life right the way from the time she was first in London in the 60s, taught me how to cook, taught me how to work frugally, taught me how to photograph in a way that meant that you'd never feel exhausted because you can always work longer in the day. And so those kinds of people, there's a lot, you know.
Oh, yeah. Marketa's I did invite her on to the podcast and she politely declined as flat out, just no. And I fully respect that. Didn't feel obliged to give me a reason or anything. Just didn't want to do it. It's fine. I digress. So Now, when you feel kind of overwhelmed or unfocused or creatively spent or uninspired, what do you do to get yourself moving forward again? Is there any? Do you have any particular sort of strategies that you employ?
I don't really feel that way. I feel frustrated, you know, in terms of time and in terms of sometimes in terms of energy a little bit, but I think part of what I've done over the years is shift the technical process that I would work with, because you get excited about a new process. So moving from the square format to the 6.7 process to the digital SLR, you know, then to the rangefinder SLR I've been using recently. There's never really that kind of, I suppose it's about being, you're talking about being nourished, aren't you? You know, and that comes from so many different ways. That comes from, you know, listening to something on a Sunday night. There's a really lovely appreciation of John Berger along with the thing I was listening to yesterday, and it talks about he makes you see the world in a slightly different way, and boy oh boy, that's absolutely true. So it's about finding these different bits of nourishment, and I do get them from, you know, I've got a network. You know, my favourite pub in Wales was a pub called the Murringer, which is still run, and he's still keeping it ticking over, even though it's now dormant, everything's ready to go for when we get through this phase that we're all going through. But this is a man who would give you a copy of a Robert McFarlane book for over the counter, you know. So the thing, without wanting anything in return, and these people nourish me, these people are really important to me, and those kinds of networks are great, you know. Every so often I'll get an email out of the blue from America, from Killip, saying, have you seen Tilde Jensen's pictures of the homeless, you know? And all of a sudden you look at it, you think, fuck, everything's changed. There's something that, to use his phrase, this is something you just can't ignore. And yeah. And I suppose figuring out what those things are is always kind of always on the go. So it's never that things come to a dead stop. They might slow down, but you know. And then I find going out walking, going out photographing is, you know, you're back in it. It's no problem.
Well, sort of on a sort of similar note, and we've sort of already talked about it to some extent, but there's a question about what other art forms or cultural output do you take inspiration from, you know? And I know we've already mentioned literature. So, I mean, you know, maybe some people may be painting or poetry or, you know, even TV. Are there any favorite artists or even kind of more pop culture programs or websites that you find essential?
Yeah, there's a lot that I touch base with all the time. You know, I'm kind of driven by box sets, you know, and that you know, the last few years, David Simon's stuff from The Wire right the way through to Treme, and I was in New Orleans, you know, which was an amazing, by chance, honor to be able to go there and do something, and just to kind of figure out that kind of connection between creative development in terms of music and kind of social history through things like Treme is just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal. So I think things like that, they almost feel dangerous because they're so well done, because they feel like you're part of that. They feel like you'd recognize some of the people in those environments in a way that they're your contemporaries or your friends, and that gets powerful, and they become social documents, I think, in a way that some of the newspapers might lag behind on a little bit in the way that we now work. And then, you know, you can probably can't see behind me, but I've got, you know, the room's full of music, and it's full of everything from the kind of music you'd expect someone to listen to as somebody who grew up in the 70s, right the way through to things which are much more, I suppose, eclectic or vernacular, you know, folk music of people like Kenny Anderson, King Creosote, and things like that, which are absolutely beautiful and make that really beautiful leap between being just another song to being a song about something that feels like it's from that place, which, you know, we get through photography. We always talk about that through things like Eggleston's way of using colour in the American South, or Goldblatt's work with the light in South Africa being so harsh. You know, here, you know, in the north of Scotland, it's things like him. In Liverpool, it's musicians like Michael Head, who the NME once called the greatest songwriter of his generation, but nobody's heard of him, or I'm paraphrasing that, but who actually probably is for me, and can talk about, or can write about, when he's compelled to do so, scenarios which you almost understand the streets from those situations. They're absolutely beautiful. But then this is a lad who, even though he's from the central Liverpool, just writing music that probably comes from a pop tradition, would also be in the central libraries looking at madrigals and how people sing in the round and figuring out all these different things. These are people who've got absolute initiative. They're the people I come from for inspiration, as well as all the usual, you know, never too far away from country and western or reggae, but these people are absolutely right there for me, you know.
Mm-mm. What is the thing that you like the most about photography or being a photographer? And then what's the thing you like the least?
The thing I like the most is coming back in after photographing for a day and knowing that you've done something good, knowing that something shifted, knowing that you might have something. You don't quite know you do, but knowing that you might have something. And it's reaffirmed everything. It's connected you with people again. It's all of a sudden, I can't remember who said it, but I was in the photographer's gallery once at one of those panel discussions, and I was just sitting in there watching a whole group of people. It might have been one of those Citibank things, but, and somebody said, "What do you think about when you're making pictures?" And I can't remember who it was that said it, but they said, "Well, when it's going really well, I'm not thinking about anything." And I thought, "Fuck, you're right. That is what." That I remember that, and that seems right, because everything else just goes off on a tangent and gets parked somewhere. So I like that experience. I like the connection. You know, you mentioned Anders Pettersen, who's a beautiful man, you know, talking about needing to be a touching distance to know he exists. You know, what a turn of phrase he's got. Wow, I wish I could be him. And then the other side of it, the less I don't know. I love the energy. I love the busyness. I love the fact that there's so much interest in photography, but I could probably step back from being part of the social media world sometimes, yeah. You know, and I suppose over time, that's what I've done. I've just stepped further and further back, you know. I'm not part of that world now, thankfully. It just got me head back.
So the last question, I hate asking this question. I don't know what, well, I do know why. It's kind of a bit, there's something very kind of raw and uncomfortable about asking this one, but are you happy?
Am I happy? I don't think about it too much. If I was smart, I'd think of something snappy, and I am quite smart. So I'll say that fail better, which is Beckett, isn't it? Fail better. And so I'm measured more than happy. You know, I'm on the day to day, you know, very, very, very content. Because I understand things aren't going to turn themselves around too quickly. So I don't worry about that, but at the same time, sometimes I'm probably quiet, and it could be misconstrued that I wasn't happy, but I'm just figuring things out, and that's okay.